BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 196, almost at 200 podcasts. We've been doing this over here at BadQuaker.com for about a year and a half now. And as I've been telling you on each one of these here lately, we're in the process. We're working with a company called Notion 3, N-O-T-I-O-N 3. And we're in the process of upgrading the website, and so it shouldn't be long, and you should be able to see the progress that we're making, and you should be able to see the whole new the new layout of the of what the website's going to look like. And of course, they're doing that for us because they support what we're doing. We appreciate that from Notion 3. And as I've said the last few times, some of the things that people have been asking for, we're going to try to incorporate those into the new website. It's still going to be the same web address. It's just going to look completely different. So we're going to try to incorporate things like the book list and some type of a forum or some type of a place where, you know, there can be more social interaction between the listeners. And hopefully there will be more actual posting of articles, both by myself and other contributors. Maybe even listeners can be contributors to articles. You know, it's all according to how we get it all set up, and nothing is really in concrete at this point. I also wanted to mention something that I kind of fumbled around with in my interview with Bob Murphy that I did the other day. I recorded that Saturday and then released it yesterday. And really, I thought, great, I'm going to be, you know, a day ahead of time here. I'm going to, you know, be up one podcast. I can get ahead and you know, nah, it didn't happen that way. So I'm back to my regular schedule. But I did say something, you know, there was a moment where I kind of stumbled around in a circle when I was talking to Bob because I couldn't remember the reference from Franz Oppenheimer. Franz Oppenheimer had a great book. He was a German thinker, and he had a great book that was originally written in German, and then it was translated into English, and the name of it is The State, and I'll put a link to it in today's show notes. That'll probably be the only link in today's show notes. Of course, you know, nothing is set, so, you know, the future, who knows. I may come up with something else halfway through this podcast and then end up with more links in the show notes. So, you know, hate to speak of the future in positive in absolute terms. But anyway, in Franz Oppenheimer's book, The State, he lays out the argument that, well, he lays out several really valuable arguments. But one of them is that there are two ways that that people support themselves. There is the economic means. And by the economic means, that means that you grow something, you manufacture something, you make something, you provide a service for someone, you do something that's of value, and then you exchange. There's a voluntary exchange, and you get things that you want, and they get things that they want, and this is all within the economic means. It's the productive class of people in society. So the economic means is any time that voluntary exchange takes place between people. But then there's the political means. Now, the political means is when someone obtains the things that they want in life, the things that they need in life, and they use some method other than voluntary exchange. So, for example, the guy hiding in a dark alley who jumps out and robs a person as they walk by, that guy is actually using the political means because he's using you know, the power of aggression and force and intimidation and so forth in order to get what it is that he wants. And that's identical to the tax man who uses the exact same method. He uses force and aggression, intimidation, these things, or possibly a deceiver, a person who has a stand on the side of the street, and it appears as though he has an honest card game going on, but what he actually does is he tricks people using a simple con, and therefore he's not an honest, it's not a voluntary exchange in the sense that fraud is being used. So no one can be voluntarily defrauded. It's illogical, you know, to try to place that into that same category. So anytime fraud is used to obtain, what it is you want from a person, then that's not voluntary, because you can't. It's kind of like, and you can't have voluntary theft. Kai's talked about this a couple times on the podcast. If you say, hey, I want to steal a French fry from you, and the person says, okay, go ahead, well, that's a voluntary sharing. It's not theft. You can't steal something that's actually voluntarily given. So any time that fraud is used, or any time that aggression is used to obtain a person's livelihood, their sustenance, or whatever, then that is not the economic means. That is the political means, and that includes the simple robber on the street, the con man on the street, and it also includes the tax man, the president, the policeman. Even in situations where a valuable service is being rendered, let's say a fire department or ambulance service, if that is by voluntary method, and I don't mean that the person volunteers to be a fireman and doesn't get paid for it. That's not at all what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the voluntary means of exchange, whereas I say I want to pay an insurance company $100 a month, and they want to make that exchange with me, and in return they hire a fire company to come to the service of a burning house if in case my house actually catches on fire. So this is a voluntary, this is the economic means, because it's voluntary. On the other hand, if a local government says, we're going to tax every house in the neighborhood, let's just say even the same amount of money, even $100 a month. We're gonna tax every house in the neighborhood $100 a month, and you're gonna pay it, or we're gonna send a guy out with a gun, and he's gonna either take the money from you, or he's gonna arrest you, or he's gonna take your house, or one way or the other, we are gonna provide the exact same service to you as the insurance company would have, except we're gonna do it at the barrel of a gun, and at the threat of taking your property away. Well, then that's the political means. It is no longer the economic means. Any time that this exchange becomes based on aggression and not based on a voluntary exchange, then it becomes the political means. And that's what I was, you know, it just blinked out of my mind the other day when I was talking to Bob Murphy. And I'm sure he knew what I was talking about. But, you know, sometimes you just get those old person moments where your brain just doesn't click in like it's supposed to. Anyway, so that I took a long time there to explain what I was talking about with Bob, but and I can't even remember the context of how I was talking to what I was talking to Bob about. But you know, when you make some kind of a mistake like that, it just sticks with you for days until you get it cleared out of your head. Now, another thing that I've been talking about lately is this difference in kind and difference in degree. And I wanted to real quick again just touch on the importance of recognizing when I talked about groups that use terminology that makes it sound like they're doing the same thing that, you know, that the people in the liberty movement are wanting to do or wanting to get accomplished, when in fact, you know, they mean a whole different set of things by the words that they use. So even the word liberty, to some people, you use the word liberty and they think right away of some right-wing conservative thing where, you know, you want a bigger military and you want, all the things that go with right-wing extremism. So even these simple words like liberty, even the word libertarian, you know, to some people that means a whole different thing than what it actually is supposed to mean. So separating out the difference in kind among us and really finding out, is this organization working towards the real goal of liberty, or are they working to make the government bigger and stronger and more intrusive? And, you know, and then there's difference in degree. Is this organization similar to us as far as the same, you know, the same ultimate goal? We understand what liberty is. We adhere to the zero aggression principle or the non-aggression principle. And, you know, and this is really what we want, except there's a variation in their method. There may be, maybe they're a little confused, and maybe they still think that they can somehow use the government to influence the government and make things better or something. So we have a difference in degree there, but they're the same kind as us. And I talked about different organizations that fit that mold one way or the other. But and my purpose in bringing that up again is to just stress the importance of knowing the destinations you're trying to get to, understanding the destination, and then focusing on what it's going to take to get there without repeating the same mistakes or without shooting off in the wrong direction. Because again, you know, like I said the other day, if you're in New York and you're headed towards Los Angeles, and you're flying in as straight a line as possible, you don't have to be off by very much to completely miss your target, to completely land in a totally different location. And so for that reason, we have to make sure that our focus and our direction is going in the right way, using the resources that we have at our disposal in the most efficient means possible. Because, you know, really, in the overall scheme of things, time and our resources are precious. Time is one of our resources, but all of our resources in the liberty movement are limited and precious. And so when we waste time and effort and energy and, you know, emotion and money, when we waste these things on a direction that's not necessarily going where we ultimately want to go, then, you know, we can't get that back. It's gone. It's wasted. And so much of the energy and money and effort of the liberty movement in the last 10 years especially has gone just completely in the wrong direction. It's gone into, you know, trying to get the government to be a nicer, better government, to try to get our master to beat us less, or trying to get our master to give us one more day, you know, of freedom before they throw us back in the salt mines. And this is so contrary to having to efficiently using our resources. So one of the things I want to focus on today, and I know I've talked a long way to get around the bush to get to where I'm going to actually introduce my topic. I want to talk to you today about the future and about our direction and about whether or not we're really understanding what's coming at us, and if we're, you know, if we're just hyping certain aspects, things like the economy, or, you know, there's so many people that are so wrapped up in prepping or in, you know, storing up guns and ammunition and rice and beans and stuff, or they're, you know, I want to talk, are we really using our resources the way that we should be in preparation for the future and what's coming at us? And are we shooting towards a reality, a possible, a reachable goal? What kind of a future can we realistically look for, and how can we get there? And so that's the topic that I'm going to work on today. And I've kind of set this up now for a while. You know, I had Glenn Tate, the author Glenn Tate, on the podcast the other day, and his book's going to come out in another week or so. I had Kevin Gutzman on, and we talked about history, and I also let him talk about what he felt was coming at us in the future. And I also had Bill Buport on, and Bill Buport has a very realistic view of what's coming at us in the future. In a sense, now, if you just think about these three different men here, Glenn Tate's vision of the future, and the, you know, in his words, the coming 299 days when that happens. Kevin Gutzman has a very realistic view of the future, but then then he sort of comes to a point where he cuts it off and doesn't want to think about the next step beyond that. And I'm not saying that to put him down. It's just that all of us only see, you know, it's kind of like a big stained glass window. Each of us is looking through a pane of glass that's right in front of us, and we see the future, you know, to a certain degree, it's distorted specifically by the pane of glass that we're looking through. And so someone standing right shoulder to shoulder next to us who's looking through a different pane of glass may get a slightly different vision of the future, while somebody else may only see a limited distance or whatever. So, you know, if we sew these together and try to get a realistic idea of what we really are facing, and the good aspects and the bad aspects together, a very realistic idea of what we can expect, then I think in the long run we're going to be far more prepared and far more adaptable to what comes at us than if we just latch on to one vision of the future and focus everything around that one vision. I'm thinking specifically, if you think back about other people in the past who have had ideas of what the future was going to look like, and you can, and this is not, you know, any one specific person. There have been several, quite a few people who have in the past who have looked forward and imagined what the future would be like. And you might have a brilliant man that looks ahead and sees the future, but then he very foolishly force fits it into his own generation. So for this reason, you have, you know, sometimes people are considered religious nuts or kooks or whatever, because they look ahead and they say, you know, well, this is going to happen or that's going to happen. Maybe they believe the, you know, Jesus is going to return in their lifetime, and they put all their efforts on that one return at a specific date or within a specific time frame or something like this. And they may have like 80 or 90% of their vision might be correct. It's just that they've tried to force fit it into their own generation. And so the time frame comes and goes and they look foolish, but really that was unnecessary. All they did was just miss this one little aspect. So I want to kind of look at that today and see if we can maybe take a look at the future that might be a little bit more realistic, a little bit more balanced. And we'll see what kind of hope there is and what kind of preparations realistically should be made for it. Okay, stick with me. I'll be right back, and we'll get into this topic. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break there. Now, again, you know, I want to talk about looking at the future with more in mind than one generation. Humans tend to just think about one generation at a time. Even when we look backwards at history, we tend to see it through the eyes of our own generation. And so, of course, when we look forward into history, we tend to think of it only in terms of our own generation. So hopefully we can step away from that. And, you know, the other problem is that humans are so easily distracted, all of us. The most simple of us and the most brilliant of us, it takes so little to distract us and get us to think about something other than the real point of a matter. So, so we do want to focus and try not to allow single events or series, limited series of events to distract us from really the bigger points of what is going on and the direction we need to go. Again, we don't want to put a lot of effort into a direction and then find out down the road that our direction is flawed. So going back, you know, I have talked to Glenn Tate, I talked to Kevin Gutzman, I talked to Bill Buepert, and I would encourage anybody that hasn't heard those interviews to go back and listen to them. And then, of course, there was the one yesterday, the interview with Bob Murphy, and he and I talked about the future and about the economics instability of the current system that we have, and I got Bob to project ahead and say, okay, now, so what kind of a system, when the current system begins to wobble so bad that it's so obvious that it's no longer sustainable, what are they going to do? What are the powers that be? What are the, you know, what are the geniuses that control the banking system worldwide? They have to see this coming. They have to be planning for it. And indeed, Bob said, yeah, basically, this is exactly what they'll do. And he laid it out. And I think he's dead right on target with what he was talking about. And upcoming now, in addition to all the people I just now talked about that have been on the show, I'm talking to a friend of mine named Jake Shannon, and I've known him on the internet for a number of years. He's a great guy. He's been very important in the Libertarian Party in Utah, and he's a very interesting individual, and he has a new book that's coming out in reference to the future as well. So we'll get him on the show, and I'll get him to tell you about his views, his new book that's coming out, and what his views are of what this is all going to look like in the with Jake specifically within the very near future, within our generation. But then again, stepping back further and thinking about what Bob Murphy was talking about there, we have let's look at it this way. There's a couple of ways that you can look at the future. You can think of it in terms of doom and gloom. I'm thinking about somebody like Gerald Celente, who is a very brilliant man, but he has a very dark outlook for what's coming at us. And you think about like Glenn Tate's book there, 299 Days, and the collapsing of many of the systems that we depend on. And, you know, Bill Buepert was talking about that, and the possible reorganization and how things will have to be looked at completely in a different light in order to make sense of out of all this. But another way of looking at it, and many people do, look at this change that's coming as a sort of a glorious revolution. Are we going to have, you know, is it going to be doom and gloom, or will it be a glorious revolution where we come out the other end freer, with more liberty, or with some type of a new, a new constitution or something like that? Well, let's look realistically, and this is what I was talking about with Bob Murphy. There is going to be inflation. Now, this inflation may not hit us, like the Weimar inflation hit in Germany, and it may not just be a complete hyperinflation hitting us all at once. And Bob said that probably won't happen. It probably won't come at us all at once like that. You could easily see over the course of a few years where you could end up, with several times, like 200-400% inflation over the course of a few years, and that would be devastating to the economy. But it wouldn't cause a complete collapse. It would cause some problems. But, you know, things adjust, wages adjust, and so forth, and people can live through things, economic changes, amazingly well. There very well may be short-term shortages on things, And if you look back at history and you realize what's been done in the past, you can see clearly that some of these shortages would be contrived and some would be real. You think of the potato famine in Ireland, and it was an actual real shortage, and yet it was exploited by the English government in order to keep the Irish people down. And they actually, they took advantage of the situation, and they robbed the Irish countryside of things like cattle and sheep and so forth, and took them to England. That those things that could have fed the Irish people, they literally just stole it from them and wouldn't let them have it. So the starvation, to a large extent, was contrived. Even though there was a real emergency, the starvation itself was contrived by the English government. And you see the same kind of a thing happen in the Ukraine under the Soviet Union. There was some real problems that were going on, and then Stalin took advantage of that, and he used the situation to remove the population of a very dangerous area of his country that he had problems controlling. So there can be real shortages, and there can be contrived shortages. And sometimes the contrived shortages can be, can piggyback on top of the real shortages. And governments do this. It was done in China under Mao. It happened to a variety of times under a variety of dictators and leaders of different kinds. So we'll probably see something along that lines. At some time, there will be a monetary collapse. And there's practical reasons for this. From a statist point of view, there's too much wealth in the productive class currently speaking. So as happened in the 1920s into the 1930s, the ruling class will need to remove a large chunk of the wealth out of the hands of the productive class. Going back to Franz Oppenheimer's description of the two people here, the productive class and the political class, if we can look at it in that way. The productive class has gotten too wealthy at current for the political class to be comfortably in control. So the political class will utilize something like a monetary collapse or whatever to remove a lot of the wealth. And that's actually what happened when the Great Depression hit. It was a moving of the wealth of the productive class into the pockets of the political class. That's really what happened in the Great Depression. And so we're going to see something like that through a monetary collapse. But it's not the end of the world. It's not going to be the end of government as we know it. It's not going to be, this is not a glorious revolution. It's not going to be the bringing in of liberty because the government's collapsed. We will most definitely see some changes, but that doesn't mean that there won't be a United States of America or whatever. There will be change. At some point in time, when a monetary collapse takes place, there's going to be a moment when government paychecks stop flowing. And, Bob Murphy talked about that, Glenn Tate talked about it, Kevin Gutzman talked about it, if I recall, Bill Buford talked about that. And, that's inevitable. That may happen for 1 month, that may happen for 6 months, that may happen for longer, but at some point that's inevitable because within the transition in this monetary collapse, something is going to have to give somewhere. And then, of course, you can expect if you're in a big city and all of a sudden the welfare checks and the police paychecks cut off on the same day, you can expect some problems. But those who are not dependent on the system and who have properly prepared for this kind of a situation, that's not going to be that big of a deal for them. But there will be, to a certain extent, in places, there's going to be panic in the streets. Local government is going to break down, not everywhere, not all at once. But there will be, that will be happening. But at this point, you're going to see a rebirth of government in a new form. And this new form may be, in ways, far more oppressive than anything we've seen before, but in other ways, it may be far more palatable than anything that we've seen before from government. Now, what I mean by that is, you know, getting back to those in the productive class and that are actually producing things, the government needs those people desperately producing and needs them, you know, for tax purposes. So so there's going to be, as quickly as possible, the new monetary system will be put into place, a new international currency, like Bob Murphy was talking about, something from the IMF, something maybe even gold-based, something, you know, based on a collection of different items. It could be based on gold and oil and corn or something like this, and then the money will be issued, you know, accordingly. But one way or the other, government is not just going to fold up its tent and disappear. It's going to shift. And when it shifts, in many ways, it has to be more palatable to the working public, to the productive class. And yet, in other ways, you're going to see aspects of oppression that we've never seen before. Okay, now, when this new form of government is born, this new international currency is born with it, we're going to be looking at some type of possibly a virtual or a partial government, a global government of some kind. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, necessarily the new world order paranoia. I'm not necessarily talking about that kind of thing. But there are aspects of that that are not only likely, they're logical. Like I was talking about with Bob yesterday, the most logical way to avoid these constant ongoing wars and all these other things is to have some type of a single government that manages worldwide. And that's the obvious goal of anyone who's a true statist. So whether it will be a complete one world government with one single dictator head, I doubt that. I really do. But there will be some type of a world committee of some kind that controls government, and then it'll be, you know, separated out onto local levels, and it'll be like all other governments that have ever existed. It's going to try to do all these things that it wants to do, but it's not going to be successful, because no government is ever successful in really providing the services that it claims that it's going to. So again, in many ways, it's going to be more oppressive than anything we've ever seen before, and yet, in ways, it's going to be more palatable. I don't think we're going to see the kind of taxation that we see even now. I think there's going to be, at least temporarily, there will be a reprieve of the kind of oppressive taxation. And there might even be what is considered peacefulness. There might even be less wars for a time. Not forever, but for a time. Now, during this transition into this new government, you have to keep in mind a couple things. Europe, Asia, and North America are going to need to be subjugated, and there's going to need to be a pacification that takes place. Now, those can sound like pretty ominous words, but there's a rebellious spirit within the Europeans and within North America and within certain aspects of Asia that are going to need to be dealt with by this new government. And at the same time, the Europe, Asia, and North America are, in a sense, going to be the engine of this state. Yeah, the management of the state is all going to be based in North America, Europe, and Asia. The exploitation of Africa and South America are going to be the primary goal of this state. But the engine, the African South America will, in a sense, be the fuel of the state, where the engine of the state is going to be Europe, Asia, North America. Or you might say the management of the state will be from Asia, Europe, and North America, whereas the the victims of the state, maybe is a way to put it, will be Africa and South America. If there are major wars, once this transition is over with, those major wars will most likely be in Africa and South America. But there's going to be, during the transition, we have a problem. And the problem is that the state always has had can't manage large populations very well. Large populations are always a problem for a state. So, unfortunately, there's going to need to be a large-scale reduction in the population of India and China. And I don't know exactly how that's going to take place. I have a few really, really bad ideas of how the state might do that, and I hope that's not the case. But I fear that you have currently two atomic powers, India and China. And I know, you know, the state's tendency towards violence, and it's very likely that would be an easy method of lowering the population of those two countries. So that may be a possible thing of the future. Although, you know, what we saw in Japan with the accidental meltdown of the nuclear power plant and all that, there could be some kind of a situation between India and China that is accidental, or at least it's sold to the public as being accidental. And that could be a method of reducing the population. Or there could be some other method that's even too horrible for me to imagine. But one way or the other, for the state to really come into its fullness, there's going to need to be a reduction, a large-scale reduction in the population of India and China. So, you know, the horrible things that some of the doom and gloom people project on the U.S., I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but the U.S. really doesn't have a population problem. It's got a rebellious streak that the government is going to need to deal with, but it doesn't have a population problem. Really, the whole Western Hemisphere doesn't have a population problem. We have a very manageable population, but that's not the case in India and China. And the state really, you know, like Bob Murphy was talking about in yesterday's show, more people are actually a boom to the economy in a free economy. But in a completely government-controlled economy, more people become a burden to the state in managing those people. So just like with Stalin and just like with the English dominating the Irish, something bad is going to have to happen between India and China for this state to come into its fullness. Now, getting away from the unpleasantness of that for a moment, just keep this in mind, that we can't successfully, you know, the state's been around for 11,000 years, and we can't successfully fight an 11,000-year-old beast if we only think in terms of one human generation. And I think that's the great flaw that so many people have fallen into throughout the ages, is looking at the state and thinking of it only through our own generation that's existing at that time, when realizing that this monster is really old, and it has a long-term goal, and it's moving towards that goal as quick as it can. And we, on the other side of this equation, mostly have no goal at all. So now I'm going to break again, and when I come back, I'm going to talk about that goal, and I'm going to talk about a little bit about a different way of looking at this, perhaps. Okay, stick with me. I'll be right back. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through that break, and let's see if we can wrap this up here and make some kind of a positive end to this, because it kind of sounds pretty bad. Everything that I've spelled out is sort of more doom and gloom, but it doesn't need to be that way. Again, remember the last thing I said right before the commercial break. We really need to think in terms bigger than one human generation. We need to think in terms of the overall direction that we're going. And so one generation, just within the generation that exists right now, we may not see all of these things happen. You know, things could go along exactly like they're going. Like Bob Murphy was saying, you know, they can continue playing this bubble game out for another 100, 150 years maybe. This is not necessarily going to happen in our generation as we sit and think about it today. Like so many other predictors of the future, you know, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, brilliant men in the past have said, oh, this is going to happen or that's going to happen in the future, and it didn't happen within their lifetime, so people thought they were nuts or people disregarded everything that they said. And yet there are aspects of brilliance in many of these things that people, these people that looked forward to the future, there's aspects of brilliance in many of the things that they've said throughout the centuries. So it's important that we look beyond this thinking only of our own generation. This is one of the great weaknesses in humans, is to only think of your own generation. Whereas it's one of the great strengths of the state, is that the state, as this bodiless, brainless entity that only exists in our imagination, as we believe that the state exists, and yet there it is, planning and plotting this out. We don't need committees of evil men in French chateaus, like I was talking about with Bob Murphy, planning these things out because they're, you know, they have some evil design for humanity. The state itself, this 11,000-year-old entity that exists in our minds, it has its own consciousness and its own desires and its own direction that it's taking. And as we begin to understand that mystery of the state, and we begin to understand what I was talking about in one episode of the podcast, I talked about the old movie from the 1950s, Forbidden Planet. And the monster in Forbidden Planet was a product of the imagination of the guy Morpheus in the movie. And that's kind of a picture of what the state is. The state is like that. It's a real thing that exists, and it thinks and it functions and it does stuff. But it does those things because we believe it in our minds. And at some point in time, we'll stop believing in it and it'll cease to exist. We'll wake up. Like in the movie, Morpheus would wake up and the beast would vanish because it was only in existence in his dreams. Okay, so now getting back to our topic here. So the weakness of humans is the strength of the state, that weakness to only think in one generational term, whereas the state is in the long run for this. But the weakness of the state is the power of the market. As we as humans and as individuals understand the unbelievable and unstoppable power of the market, that is the one force that exists that the state can never get its claws around, can never control, never even understand. The state can never understand the market. And at some point in time, one of two endings have to come. Either the state will destroy humanity. I don't believe that will happen, because the market is more powerful. So either the state will destroy humanity, or the market will set humanity free. Now there are these two possible futures for us. And maybe it's just an act of faith. Maybe it's just, maybe I'm naive. But I believe that the market will defeat the state at some point in time. And that will bring the freedom. That will bring, and it's the market for liberty that will drive us to see the state as it really is. Now, I want to real quick draw a picture for you here of what a farm looks like. And how do you manage cattle? I've got in my notes here, it says, how to manage cattle for fun and profit. Okay, so here's the cycle of the milk cow. First, if you want to have a good milk cow, the first thing you need to do is it needs to be pregnant. So you have a pregnant cow, and then it delivers its calf, and then you allow the calf to nurse, and the cow starts heavily producing milk, and it'll actually produce an excess of milk. So as the calf starts to grow, and about the time that the cow is naturally weaning the calf, when the calf gets too big to comfortably be nursing the cow, then the cow will begin to wean the calf and start to push it more towards eating grass. Now, about this time is when you want to begin to milk the cow and start to, you milk production begins at that stage. And you slowly start utilizing the milk that the calf was nursing and let the calf more and more go towards grass. Okay, so now you've got this cow, and the main thing, if you really want to maintain milk production, now think of this in terms of the government and of the productive class of humans. If you really want to maintain milk production, the cow must remain calm, happy, and well-fed. If a milk cow is not calm, happy, and well-fed, it will not produce the kind of milk that that it can produce under other circumstances. And sometimes all it takes is a dramatic shock or something scary or something upsetting the cow, and all milk production stops. So the smart farmer wants the cow to remain calm, happy, and well-fed. Keep that in mind. The state is going to do everything it can to keep the productive class calm, happy, and well-fed. But there's a problem in your farm here. As that calf starts to grow, either it's one of two things. It's either male or female. If it's a female, you want to move it towards the milk production side, or possibly, you know, towards, you know, production as far as having babies, having more cattle. But if that calf is a male calf, then you've got a problem with this male calf. As it starts to grow, it starts to get rambunctious. It starts to want to ram its head into things. It gets curious about stuff. It gets harder and harder to control as it gets older. So the farmer has a quick and dirty solution with this young male calf. The farmer, in one fell swoop, makes that calf into a steer. That young bull becomes a steer. With one swift move of the knife, and the rambunctious, hard-headed calf that's running around, you know, learning the ways of a young male, becomes a steer. And at that moment, that calf becomes controllable. Now, eventually, that steer will become steak. That's the natural progression in the farm. First, it's a bull, but the farmer only needs so many bulls. And so the young male calf becomes a steer, and then he becomes a steak. Now, there are bulls. The farmer will keep one or more bulls, but he keeps the bulls away from the herd because they're almost uncontrollable. The bulls are used, they're kept in a strong pen separately, or they're kept in a separate pasture. And oftentimes that's the one you put a ring in his nose to try to control him. And the bull is used for two purposes, entertainment and reproduction, and that's it. The bull is used for entertainment and reproduction. Now, the state desires dramatically to control reproduction. And when I was talking about China and India there a minute ago, one of the methods that the state might use to control the population is some type of an interference in the natural reproductive methods of human beings. And I don't want to let my imagination go in that direction, and we don't really have time in this podcast to explore the possibilities of that. We could go into science, or we could go into, I could talk about evils of genetic engineering, or, you know, there's various ways that we could go with that direction. But just keep in mind that the farmer only has two purposes for the bull. And one is for entertainment, and the other is for reproduction. Entertainment in the sense of bullfights, rodeos, showing them off at the county fair. Everything in the bull's life revolves around either being a toy for the farmer to show off and be entertained by. In our society, we could talk about sports figures. Or the only other purpose for the bull is for reproduction. And if the state gets control of reproduction in its own methods, then the bull is no longer useful for reproduction. The bull is only useful so long as he can provide entertainment to the farmers. Now, so then this thinking about the farm. All cattle on the farm are either milked, slaughtered, or used for entertainment or reproduction purposes. They serve no other function on the farm. All cattle on the farm are either milked, slaughtered, or used for entertainment or reproduction. But there are other things on the farm all the time that are not cattle. Every farm has mice on the farm. Every farm. It doesn't matter how hard you try to fight the mice. It doesn't matter how many cats you introduce to the barn. There are going to be mice in the fields, in the barn, in the farmhouse. They're everywhere. You can do everything you can to fight the mice away. It's kind of like ants. You can fight ants. You can try to exterminate ants. You can put out poison for ants. And the ants will just move around them the other direction, and the ants are always here. All of these things exist on the farm at the same time as the farmer and the cattle, but they're not a part of the farm. The sparrows, think of the sparrows. The sparrows are everywhere, or any other little Tweety bird like that that you might have regionally on whatever area of the world that you have your farm. You're going to have a variety of birds, I'll just use sparrows as an example, rather than going in, because that's what we have here in Ohio. Actually, we have starlings. We have lots and lots of starlings. And there's nothing farmers can do about the starlings. They can put out poison. They have these cannons that are noise cannons that just shoot puffs of natural gas. And they make noise to try to scare the birds away from the fields. But no matter what the farmer tries to do, there's always going to be starlings. That's one of the things we have here in Ohio. Flocks, huge flocks of out-of-control starlings. And they feed where they want to feed, and they go where they want to go, and they do what they want to do. And so the secret in the future to surviving the things that are coming at us is to simply get off the farm. Now, that doesn't mean escape society. That doesn't mean live in the woods. That doesn't mean hide in the mountains. That means don't be a cow, don't be a bull, don't be a steer. It means figure out a way that you can be a starling, figure out a way that you can be a mouse, figure out how you can be like the sparrows. There's a biblical reference in this where the Bible says that we need to be in the world, but not of the world. In other words, we can be right here among them. You can be in the depths of the biggest cities and not be dependent upon the state and its functions. That's the difference in being free. Right now, we can look ahead to some utopian future where there is no government and where eventually the state has collapsed completely and humans are free. And I believe that some version of that will come at some point in time. I was talking about it earlier, and I've talked about it many times. The market for liberty will become so great. As the state grows and the state becomes stronger and stronger, the market for liberty will grow right along with the state. The difference is that the state can't understand the functions of the market, and the state can never get a grasp on the market. So the market is going to be the power that the state can never fully get control of, and the market will bring the state down. And specifically the market for liberty, as the state grows and fights to control the market in everything else, it will drive the market in liberty, and people will want more liberty, and they'll desire more liberty. And at some point in time, that desire for liberty will supersede the state's ability to support itself. And, and I've talked about before how a person walks around in their life day to day and never really thinks about air until the moment comes that they can't catch their breath, until the moment comes that they can't breathe for whatever reason. And then all of a sudden they realize how desperately they need air and how important it is that they have air. And a person will fight vigorously to get air once they realize they don't have it. And this is the same way with liberty. Liberty can only be really appreciated when it's being taken away. And as the state grows and as oppression grows and as liberty is taken away and more oppression is put on people, people will have a greater and a greater desire for liberty. And at some point a saturation level will happen and people, and in the meantime, and you know, I've said that before, that the state will just will not be able to maintain its grip on everything once there's that big of a desire for liberty. But at the same time, we have a job between now and then, and that is in the education realm. We have to be prepared. Sure, it's great to have emergency supplies. It's great to have extra food in your pantry. It's great to have 6 months or a year's worth of food saved up to get by any emergency that might come up in your family, a loss of job, a local economic collapse of some kind. All of those things are really important to prepare for. But we also have to prepare in educational terms among ourselves. We have to make sure that we among ourselves have chosen the right path. Remember, I was talking about wasting resources on these organizations that are trying to make government more efficient or make government more palatable or all these different things. Rather than wasting our resources on those things, we need to focus on the educational end and refine what it is that we believe and push ourselves to a position where we fully understand this beast, this 11,000-year-old monster that seeks to dominate us. We understand it, we understand its weaknesses, and we develop an economy that's not based on reliance upon it. I've talked before about, you know, imagine a world where there's a jewelry shop or a coin shop, let's just say a coin shop in Kansas City, Missouri, and there's a jewelry shop in Chicago. And there's a communication between us and the Liberty Movement, and you can give a call to your local place, to your local jewelry shop in Chicago, and say, hey, I need to move, you know, $100 to my nephew who lives in Kansas City. And this connection is made, and it's entirely outside of the state. And maybe it'll utilize something like bitcoins or some other process, maybe precious metals or anything that's outside of the grasp of the state. And the move and the money is moved, and the support is done, and the state has nothing to do with it. And as we learn among us how to do these things and everything else, I just use that as one example. But every other aspect of the market that can be done without state involvement, as we learn how to do these things, we will come to a position of where we will be the starlings on the farm. We will be the mice. We will be not only unmanageable, but the state won't. It'll be just like we're not in the inventory. We're not even, the state doesn't even recognize us as being there. We will walk among them and not be part of them. And that's how we win. That's how we prepare. That's what we shoot for. And then when the state finally gets to its position where it has consumed as much as it can consume, and the masses will tolerate it no longer, and all the bad things that happen to the state in the long run, like I've talked about before, and we who have already built a separate economy will just step away from it and stop supporting it, and the thing will vanish. And then it'll fall to the ground like a great statue. And, you know, you think of the Colossus of Rhodes. If you're not familiar with the Colossus of Rhodes, it was a massive statue that stood in the harbor of Rhodes. And at one point there was an earthquake and the thing tumbled down. And then the body of that statue laid there for hundreds of years as a testimony of the audacity of the state. And eventually the thing was scrapped. But for all that time, there was nothing but a dead statue laying there. People walked around it and looked at it. And that's the future of the state. That's what we're going to see. But again, not our generation. It's a long ways off. We have to think in bigger terms than just one generation. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast today. And as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much.